Paris 1 week after the attacks. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 7 days on, Paris is still coming to grips with what happened. The neighborhoods where the attacks took place still bear the scars from that night.
Since I'm 3 years old and I can eat, we buy the croissant here. And here we have the...
Right over here? And
right over here where you see the bullet on the glass.
Also, we check back in with a bystander who helped us cover the attacks last Friday.
I mean, I feel pretty traumatized by the whole thing, and I don't know how those people inside are waking up in the morning.
He's referring to those who survived the siege at the Bataclan Theater. Plus, we visit the Great Mosque in Paris, now guarded by soldiers around the clock. That's all coming up today, here on The World. And a week after the attacks in Paris, another hostage crisis. The one today happened in Bamako, the capital of Mali in West Africa. It's over now, but earlier in the day, armed men stormed the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, where a lot of Westerners stay. The attackers reportedly were shouting, "God is great," in Arabic. The precise death toll has been hard to verify, but authorities say at least 27 people were killed. It's not clear if that includes any of the gunmen. At one point, the militants held more than 170 people hostage on the top floors of the Radisson. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Ramata Jaoure in Bamako. He told me the siege started early.
It all starts quite early in the morning at around 7 in Bamako, when some people with weapons came in a car in front of the name Radisson Blue. What we have heard is that they first entered the hotel using the guns, and they directly went to the seventh floor. All the troubles began here.
The crisis lasted several hours until Malian security forces stormed the building. Afterwards, one of the hotel guests spoke to reporters.
I heard gunshots very early in the morning. I thought it was firecrackers and didn't realize it was a hostage situation. I left to go to the hotel restaurant, and then I saw that there was a lot of smoke, so I returned to my room. At one stage, the Malian forces came to get us. They knocked on our doors and evacuated us in small groups via the stairs.
Security forces apparently went from room to room checking for additional casualties. Mali was a French colony, and France has stationed troops there in recent years to battle an Islamist insurgency in the north of Mali. So I asked reporter Ramata Jaoure whether authorities in Bamako are seeing a link to last Friday's attacks in Paris.
Nobody, even in the police or in the military or even in foreign people living in Mali, are talking about a link between the Paris attack and the Bamako attack.
No linkage to Paris, and Jaoure says this hostage taking at the Radisson did not surprise a lot of residents in Bamako.
Not really. A lot of people know that Bamako is not really what you can call a secure city. And we have
a lot of
groups that can do attacks. It is not really, really surprising.
That's reporter Ramata Jaoure in Bamako early today. A little more context now on the violence in Mali. This is a place where war broke out in 2012 in the north. First a rebellion by Tuareg separatists, then Islamist fighters joined forces with them. The French army entered the battle and helped Malian forces reclaim the north, but there are still skirmishes. Journalist Andy Morgan has been closely watching the fighting over the past few years. He used to manage several musicians from Mali, and he knows the country really well. After years in the music business, he began focusing his writing on Mali's insurgency. I spoke with him today from his home in Bristol in the UK.
Mali, especially northern Mali, is not a place where you can easily crush a rebellion. It's a very, very huge territory. It's surrounded by very porous borders that are easily crossed by local people. So therefore, basically, the jihadist insurgents basically went underground when the French arrived in 2013 and have been more or less on and off waging a low-level guerrilla stroke terrorist war since then. This is another more major chapter in that ongoing struggle.
Mali is a huge country, most of it the Sahara Desert in the country's northeast, and that's where most of the fighting during the rebellion took place. How surprising is it that this attack took place in the capital?
Unfortunately, the jihadi activities have been slowly drifting south over the last year. One of the reasons for that is that there's a new jihadi group on the scene called the Massena Liberation Front, which suddenly popped its head up a year ago and started attacking a lot of places, a lot of police and military installations in the center of the country. And there have also been various attacks in Bamako recently. There was one at a cafe back in March, a cafe called La Terrasse, very popular with foreigners. Five people lost their lives in that attack. It has to be said, though, that this is only the second major attack in Bamako, the capital, which is a place that until very recently most people felt was safe for Westerners to visit and to work in. Unfortunately, that now might be changed by today's events.
Give us your assessment of the security forces in Mali. It's one of the world's poorest countries. Do they have the capacity to deal with all of this?
Historically, in the last 10 years, I think it has to be said that the Malian army and security forces have been very ineffective, very poorly trained, very low morale. I think this has changed. One of the reasons is that the EU and America and other outside nations have been pouring a lot of money into the Malian military, and it is beginning to have some effect. Having said that, people, I think, say that, especially in the north of Mali, the real effective fighting force is the French Barkhane. Barkhane is a mission that started about a year ago, involves French special forces. They've been chasing jihadists in the north of Mali for the last year or so. They're the real force in the country. After them is MINUSMA, which is the UN mission to Mali. And the Malian army are on the third tier. And my understanding is that the people who are dealing with this hostage siege at the Radisson are a mix of French forces, MINUSMA, and Malian forces.
Talk a bit more about the French role in Mali. Mali is France's former colony. Did that aggravate the situation even while they were trying to help Mali put down the insurgency? And what's France going to do now? Will it step up its involvement again there?
Mali have this terrible, complex relationship with France. It is the ex-colonial power. I think it was with a great sense of loss of face that they had to call France in to save the country, really, in January 2013, when the jihadists started pushing south from their northern enclave and the capital, Bamako, was actually menaced at that time. So the French came in, they put the country together again. François Hollande was welcomed as a hero in Bamako and in Timbuktu. But very quickly, I think public opinion has turned against them for various reasons. One is that a lot of people feel that they're more pro-Tuareg separatists than they are pro-Mali, pro-the Republic. And so a lot of people resent that. But obviously for jihadists, I mean, France is public enemy number one. It is the epitome of the foreign apostate infidel force that keeps Mali from being a glorious Muslim caliphate. And the jihadists have absolute virulent hatred towards France. But the Malian population in general also have a very, very troubled relationship with them.
That's journalist Andy Morgan. Later on The World, we'll hear more from him about the Malian band Tenariwen, which he used to manage, and their performance some years ago at the Paris Music Hall, the Bataclan. That's, of course, where so many people were killed last Friday. It was not the first attack in Paris this year. 2015 started with the attack on the offices of the magazine Charlie Hebdo back in January. Reporter Daniel Estrin was reporting in Paris back then, and he met a French woman who was worried about the future of her country. This week, after the latest attacks on Paris, Daniel looked her up again, and he also met her daughter, Morgane, who knew some of the young people who were killed last Friday. Daniel spent some time walking around the neighborhood with her.
On Friday night, 19 people were gunned down at this corner café, La Belle Équipe. The patio in front is now drowning in bouquets. It's a memorial, a moment frozen in time. But take a moment to see it through the eyes of 24-year-old Morgane Blancourt. She's lived here all her life. Next door to the cafe is her favorite pâtisserie.
Just here, there's the place where I buy my croissant in the morning since I'm 3 years old and I can eat. We buy the croissant here. And here we have the...
Right over here?
Right over here where you see the bullet on the glass.
The window that usually displays beautiful croissants and cakes now has two bullet holes. On Friday night, friends of friends were celebrating a 25th birthday at the cafe. One died. Another was shot in the leg, and her foot was amputated. Another was shot in the back. They don't know if she'll walk again.
This part of the neighborhood is dead now because the restaurant Sushi Maki is not open, this patisserie is not open, like, and all the people look like you took a part of them.
I'm looking at this woman over here with a A crutch, I wonder. I wonder if she was injured. She was standing in front of the cafe, shaking her head. Morgan approached her. Her name is Rachel Saville, a graphic designer from Canada. She had plans to eat with friends at another restaurant, Le Petit Cambodge, around the time it was attacked.
And I fell off my bike instead, coming home before dinner. So I ended up, I was in Saint-Pilpé, the hospital on the 13th, just getting x-rays and stuff on my foot.
And so your friends went to the...
They didn't go as soon as I canceled. They canceled, so, yeah.
That's amazing. You saved their lives, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It's just so emotional even being here and seeing all of this, you know?
She wiped a tear rolling down her cheek. Morgan took me down the street to a cafe where she knows the waitresses by name. Last Friday, the cafe was turned into a makeshift hospital. The wounded were brought in, and the dead were laid out on the street. Authorities called on people in apartments overlooking the street to throw down sheets to cover the bodies. Morgan's friend threw a sheet from the window.
When I saw that there were some attacks in Paris, the first word I say is that, but are they stupid or what? Like, they let them go from one place to another and they shot people in Israel that would have been blocked immediately. I mean, for sure.
Morgan lived in Tel Aviv for a year. Even before the attacks, she decided she wanted to immigrate there. But a few days after the attacks, she hurried and finished filling out her application.
I feel safe in Israel. I don't feel safe in Paris. It's weird. In Israel, everybody has to do the army, so of course a lot of the population know how to fight and know how to respond to an attack, so I feel protected. They have the good reflex, you know? And here we don't.
Morgan's mom, Isabel, was at home last Friday and heard the gunshots. She didn't know what it was.
It's the first time in my life that I've heard Kalashnikov. Yes, I think suddenly we realize that we are kind of... naive, and we don't even imagine that someone can attack us.
Her boss at work is Israeli. She said he made a comment at work.
What he said, very slightly and not too firmly, is that we are kind of too kind with extremists, and that a good reaction could be to punish the families. What Israel does.
Israel has a policy of demolishing the homes of families whose relatives carry out deadly attacks on Israelis.
He said, and my daughter said that too, said, well, yeah, they will think twice before attacking people if they knew that their family would be attacked. I think if we arrive to that point, we will have lost our soul.
Her daughter has made her decision. She's leaving France. Isabel is staying put.
It sounds like this is... You're struggling at this moment. You don't know what France should become. It has to change, but how?
Yes, I think we're all embarrassed.
For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Paris.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. When the attacks began to unfold last Friday night in Paris, one of the people who helped us here at The World learn what was happening was Shane McMillan. He's an American photojournalist. He's in London now, but last Friday, he was visiting friends in Paris.
I was with a friend at her apartment, which is in the building right next to the Bataclan, the building that saw the biggest attack on that night. We thought it was something really small, firecrackers in the backyard, and it was obviously much more serious than that.
How long did all that go on while you were in that apartment?
If you asked me that night, I would have said like 45 minutes or something. But I think it was actually maybe more like 2 or 3 hours. Like, it's really hard to say. When you go through the timeline, it must have been probably about 2 hours.
At one point, you went actually down to the theater as people were escaping. Was the siege still going on? What was happening when you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty gun-shy myself, and I waited until the firing was over, and the police sirens subsided a bit. We walked down into the courtyard of my friend's apartment, and it was the triage center for the people who were being brought out, and I didn't actually know where they were all coming from at first. The people who were coming out were really traumatized by what had happened. And even though I'm a journalist, I wasn't necessarily ready to ask them that question in that moment. It was obvious from their faces that they had just lived through something really terrible. And I didn't want to run up to them and be like, what's going on? You know,
I actually heard that there was a bunch of psychiatrists and psychologists were dispatched immediately afterwards to help out with some of the traumatized people.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like a week later, you know, like I'm still, I mean, I'm kind of already going through a really tough week anyways. And I can see how just someone who saw it and was just there as really just a bystander, I mean, I feel pretty traumatized by the whole thing. And I don't know how those people inside are waking up in the morning. I mean, I didn't get the full story as to what was going on inside the Bataclan until very late in the night because I was afraid to ask people because I knew that it was something really bad and I didn't. Most of them had this look on their face that was like, just don't talk to me about it. Yeah. And so at some point I'd been helping this one girl out much of the evening, like kind of checking in on her. And I asked her when I kind of felt like it was appropriate. And she told me, and I mean, I haven't watched the videos. I haven't read the news because I didn't want to, because I experienced what I experienced. And I feel like the media storm that's picked up afterwards has been kind of a mess and kind of problematic in a lot of ways.
How do you see it as problematic?
You know, a lot of people in Europe are calling this our 9/11 over here. And the energy around the whole thing, the way that people ask the questions, the way the journalists talk to people, the way they talk to me, there was this sort of palpable excitement and this sort of further deepening of stereotypes and ideas and approaches to this entire thing that are not going to get us anywhere. And it's really frustrating to see that.
Can I ask you, Shane, what your own thoughts are on how to take a wretched, tragic situation and somehow turn it toward a positive?
I mean, I don't think there's anything that we can do that will make this positive. You know, this is just bad, and it's a sign of a lot of bad things that are and have been happening for a long time in the world. And when it comes home, suddenly everyone's worried about it. But the way that they're worried about it is in this sort of personal safety kind of way. You know, like I'm riding around in the train in London and I hear people talking about how they're nervous about attacks. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's one response. But another response is to further the cause of education around the world. And that's the frustrating thing, is I feel like the media latches on to this sort of sensational moment in which the lizard brain inside of all of us is afraid. You know, like I'm afraid. I walk around, I look, when I'm standing in a crowd, I was standing in a crowd last night and I was like, I was actually on a photo shoot in a club in London. And the whole time I was there, I was just like, what if a bomb goes off? You know, that is real. We all have that. But we also need to move beyond that as a society and make bigger decisions and see these things as a moment to reflect on those bigger things that are going on.
Shane, that woman you spoke with finally last Friday night outside the Bataclan, what did she tell you?
I didn't ask too many detailed questions, but she just told me that they had arrived that night. She'd worn running shoes because she wanted to jump around. It was a big concert, and she was really excited about it. And they were having a good time and rocking out. And when the first gunfire happened, they thought that it was something that was going on the stage. And then everyone hit the ground. And then these guys went around and basically executed people. And anyone who tried to run for the door was shot down, or at least they tried to. I think it was a very terrifying few hours for those who especially were stuck far away from exits. I think it was a really scary night.
Have you spoken with her again since that night?
I didn't have any pen or paper on me, and my phone was dead by the end of the evening, so I didn't have any contact information for anyone. But she was there in front of me, and I think about her every day right now. I think about her. I think about this guy who I talked to several times over the course of the night, who his face was covered in blood, and he was confused, and he spent the whole time, the whole night, trying to call his girlfriend who he'd been separated from. And the last time I saw him was out on the street on Oberkampf, like maybe at 2 in the morning, 2:30, and he still hadn't found her. And every time I think of my own partner, I think of him and whether he found her or not.
Photojournalist Shane McMillan, thank you very much for speaking with us, and you take care of yourself.
Thanks, Marco.
Gone from Paris. Later in the show, we'll remember what the Bataclan Music Hall in Paris means to the artists who played there. We'll have journalist Andy Morgan back to tell us about that. He used to manage this Malian band, Tenariwen. And Andy Morgan tells us that the concert hall may be dark right now, but
I read an interview with the manager of the Bataclan. She said, give us time, but we'll be back. And I have no doubt that they will be back.
The Bataclan and the peaceful force of musicians, that's later on The World. News headlines are next. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A week ago, the Bataclan Theater in Paris was a site of intense violence. Coming up, we hear what the venue means to musicians who've played there over the years.
There's a certain small group of venues that if you play them, you kind of arrive. And what I mean by that is that you're out of the, as we say in England rather irreverently, the toilet circuit.
That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier, we heard about the hostage situation at a hotel in the capital of Mali. Today, that is now over. But one thing that's worth noting about the siege in Bamako was the speed of the response from Malian security forces. Very quickly, they went on the attack, clearing the hotel floor by floor. There were casualties, but more than 100 hostages were freed. It was similar at the Bataclan Theater in Paris last week.
That's exactly what you want to do in this kind of a situation, Marco.
That's Scott Stewart. He's a former special agent with the State Department and has worked on hundreds of terrorism cases. He's now a security expert with the strategic intelligence company, Stratfor.
It's not a traditional hostage taking for ransom or exchange. They're in there for carnage. And it's really the lesson that we learned here domestically in the U.S. after Columbine, you know, where up to that point, the procedure had been to kind of surround it and wait for SWAT to come in. Now with active shooter protocols, the idea is to kind of go in as quickly as you can. And that's what we're starting to see, you know, in these cases overseas as well. They don't want to have a prolonged Mumbai or Baslan type siege where you really let the militants get set up and, you know, it leads to a lot more bloodshed.
Right. The Beslan crisis in Russia at the school, the hostage taking at the school. I mean, it sounds what you're describing is pretty tough. You'd have to have SWAT response teams on call 24/7.
Well, that's I mean, basically with active shooter protocols today in the U.S., is you know, you don't even wait till the SWAT gets there. You go in with whatever forces you have because, you know, the objective is, like I said, it's not a traditional hostage taking for ransom or something. These guys are in there for carnage. So as soon as you have, you know, the troops available, you go in. We've also seen similar tactics used in, for example, the Serena Hotel in Kabul recently, where that hotel has been attacked a couple times by armed assaults. So that's really the idea now is to go in there and end it instead of allowing these guys to, you know, create more havoc and kill more innocent unarmed people.
Right. And if the goal by the attackers is carnage, I suppose there is no room for negotiation.
No, when it's all about making corpses as quickly as they can, you just need to interrupt that cycle. You can't give them a free hand to operate or a free hand to set up IEDs and other things like we've seen in the Moscow theater and in Beslan. So the idea is to get in and end it quickly.
How can the officials in the SWAT team on the outside of a theater know what the goals are inside the theater by the attackers?
Well, you can tell by what they're doing and how they set up. If they come in with guns blazing and just start shooting people, it's a pretty good indication that it's not about holding hostages and negotiating. It's about carnage. And that's what we're seeing in these recent events. It's about creating the largest body count possible. And, if they can prolong that, prolong the media spectacle, so much the better. And obviously, keep increasing the body count.
How are response teams kind of prepared for these charge-in raids? I mean, isn't there a good chance they could shoot hostages by mistake or kill them in the crossfire?
Yeah, Marco, obviously one of the greatest concerns for the responding forces is collateral damage. But obviously, if you're in a scenario where the bad guys are shooting people anyways, the victims have a better chance if the security forces do come in. There is a lot of training efforts going on domestically, internationally. I know, through the U.S. Department of State, through the U.S. Special Forces and for the French forces have been working closely with the Malians and with other governments in the region to try to get them to the point where they can respond. The very last thing you want to see is a response like Mumbai, where you have the
In 2008. Yeah.
Yes. And just, allow them to do whatever they want inside the hotel. You just can't do that. You can't give them the free rein. You have to end it as quickly as possible because that's your best possible chance of saving life, especially if you have people hiding in the rooms in the hotel, people that are out of the reach. You don't want to give the attackers longer to get to them.
Scott Stewart with the intelligence company Stratfor, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
After the attacks in Paris last week, security forces swept through neighborhoods in France and in Belgium. That's because some of the suspected Paris gunmen came from a neighborhood on the outskirts of Brussels. The World's Jeb Sharp has been out talking to people in Molenbeek and sent us this story.
Molenbeek is just a quick subway ride away from downtown Brussels, and it's a place struggling to come to terms with the terrorists in its midst.
The first general reaction is that everybody understands that we cannot react in fear. The second reaction is to be afraid.
This is Sarah Corsius. I met her as she prepared for a peace vigil the other night. She's a concert organizer here in Molenbeek. She hopes the attacks on Paris will make people braver about speaking up when they notice something amiss.
The thing I learned these last days by talking to everybody is that there are people who are slightly aware of people recruiting here, but didn't tell because of not feeling responsible for this problem. You know, if your child comes to you and says, somebody talked to me about this, is the first thing you're going to do, call the police? I don't know.
She hopes people will go to the police going forward, but it's not a given, especially if there's a harsh crackdown in the neighborhood.
You have to do something repressive, meaning you have to change the policy you had vis-à-vis extremism till some years ago. You have to adapt that to the new situation. We can come back to that.
This is Johan Lehmann, an anthropologist who has run a community center in Molenbeek for decades.
But be very careful that you don't do collateral damage. And to avoid collateral damage, take care which words you use. Take care if you make a mistake in being repressive, that it was not really because you wanted to do that. Find the good balance.
Molenbeek has grown rapidly in recent years to 100,000 people. 40% are of Moroccan heritage. There are Algerians and Tunisians too, and about half the population is under 30.
Let us not be naive.
Lehmann's known about the jihadi presence here since the late 1990s. When we sit down to talk, he rattles off the names of various figures, groups, and attacks. He's been paying close attention to the words of ISIS leaders, too, and says we should all take them seriously. In 2014, ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi threatened global jihad. ISIS also made its own map of Europe, designating Brussels as part of France.
We have to enter in the mind of ISIS. We have not to reason in terms of the European Union. And if ISIS says Brussels is part of French territory, then let us be very logical.
Lehmann says he doesn't care who's at fault for the latest intelligence failure. Belgium and France need to learn from their mistakes and start coordinating better, he says. Even if they can thwart some attacks, both countries are left with the issue of how to deal with the isolation and inequality that plague communities like Molenbeek. There's a lot of pain here. I hear it in the voice of a Tunisian man called Habib, who doesn't want to give me his last name.
I don't find the words to make it easy for my daughters. You know, you see, it's not so easy for us. It's not so easy. The young people, I'm old. I have nothing more to lose. But the young people, we have to think, for the future.
We have to think for the future. Habib is 57. He used to be a waiter, but health problems keep him from work now. He blames Western foreign policy and colonialism for creating the inequalities that radicalize young people here. And he blames the U.S. in particular for what he calls terrorism management, funding and arming rebel groups when it's in the U.S. interest, as they did to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, only to feel the blowback when those groups morph to the other side in later battles. He describes a world completely out of whack, full of haves and have-nots.
It's too late. The people of Molenbeek are denied. And now, what are they doing? Yeah, because they are denied. Because
the when you say deny, you mean jobs, discrimination.
Jobs, discrimination, all what you want.
It's hard to know what to say to that. Unemployment in Molenbeek runs around 40%. Terrorism or no terrorism, kids here need better options than they're getting to build a future. For the World, I'm Jeb Sharp, Molenbeek, Brussels.
For people in Paris, it's been a week of uncertainty and fear, but there's also a fierce determination to get back to some sense of normalcy. That's been hard for the city's Muslim residents. Many of them say they feel like their fellow Parisians are looking at them with suspicion. Our own Adeline Sia spoke with some young Muslims at a local mosque.
The great mosque in Paris is guarded by soldiers in fatigues, armed with machine guns, but there's only a sporadic back check at the front door. Inside, the building looks like a traditional Moroccan mosque with colorful tiles and a tranquil patio populated with cypress trees. You'd never know that people here are on edge. I meet a couple of students getting ready for the midday prayer. Asma Abubakari Swahili is a 20-year-old biology student at a nearby university. She wears a headscarf and a matching robe. She says she finds the military presence comforting and that she hasn't been targeted in any way since the attacks. But she's worried about her community.
Peut-être avoir peur que des gens fassent des amalgames entre les musulmans et les terroristes, quoi.
Asma is concerned people will lump Muslims and terrorists together.
Et moi, j'aimerais bien que aujourd'hui en France, les.
Asma says she'd like all French people to understand that Islam is not a religion of violence. Another student here, 21-year-old Sakina, who didn't want to give her last name, is also worried.
En plus de cet état de choc, de cette grande tristesse.
She says she feels that on top of the trauma from last Friday's attacks, she and fellow Muslims will have fingers pointed at them for this. Every day, she says, she tries to be a good representative of her faith and show that it's in harmony with French culture.
Et là, tout d'un coup, tout ce travail part en lambeaux.
And then, all of a sudden, all your work is ripped to shreds, she says. She's looking to imams to work with other religious authorities to help make sure Muslims aren't cast as terrorists again. But the head of this mosque, Dalil Boubacar, who wears a three-piece suit, says he's fed up with having to prove again and again that Muslim isn't a synonym for terrorist. He blames the media.
Les médias ont le défaut de vouloir le sensationnel. Le sensationnel, c'est le monsieur avec une barbe qui va vous dire Allahu Akbar, etc. Il y en a assez.
The problem with the media is that they want sensational items. The man with a beard who's going to say Allahu Akbar and so on. Enough with that. The media need to take responsibility and calm this sensationalistic phenomenon. But they have no conscience.
C'est stupide. C'est eux.
It's stupid, he says. They're the ones who have made Islam in France what it is today, he adds. When I ask what he was going to do about it...
Je suis fatigué, madame. Je suis fatigué. Les héros sont fatigués.
I'm exhausted, madame. Heroes are exhausted, he says. And we are tired of people not doing what they're supposed to do and hope for a miracle. No. Everyone has a shared responsibility in the future of France. If nobody gives a damn, well then, that's that. outside the mosque, another student, Moussa Chalabi, accompanies a group of Palestinian kids touring the mosque. Chalabi lost someone he knew in the attacks, a Muslim woman. But despite his grief, he seems hopeful about things. He tells me he feels there's a big difference between what happened in Paris last Friday and the Charlie Hebdo attack in January. I felt real unity in the aftermath, he said, in the sense that everyone was hit. It wasn't like Muslims attacking the freedom of expression in France. It was terrorists attacking French people of all faiths. Unfortunately, there's been some retaliation against people and property and the obligatory slice of bacon stuck to the front doors of mosques, he says. Some idiots apparently think pork is to Muslims what kryptonite is to Superman, he muses. But on the whole, I feel that all French people are united against this. For the world, I'm Adeline Sia, Paris.
In other news, and there is other news today, if you're of a certain age, you might remember Jonathan Pollard. He's the former U.S. Navy analyst who was convicted of spying for Israel back in 1985. He spent the last 30 years in prison, but today he's a free man, in a way. Pollard wants to move to Israel where his wife lives. He was granted Israeli citizenship while he was in prison. But under the terms of his parole, Pollard has to stay in the U.S. for at least 5 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement today saying Israelis welcomed Pollard's release. Meanwhile, despite the hopeful news we reported earlier this week, it seems the Ebola crisis in West Africa is still not quite over. After 10,000 cases and at least 4,000 deaths, Liberia was declared Ebola-free about 3 months ago. But now health officials there are confirming 3 new cases of Ebola. Sierra Leone was declared Ebola-free earlier this month, and officials in Guinea reported this week that their last patient with the disease has recovered. It takes 42 days without any new cases for a country to be declared Ebola-free. And finally, big news about a very hot topic here in the U.S., immigration across the U.S.-Mexico border. For the first time in half a century, it seems that more Mexicans are now leaving the U.S. than coming into the country. The new numbers come from the Pew Research Center. The center found that between 2009 and 2014, slightly more than 1 million Mexicans and their families, including American-born children, left the U.S. for Mexico. During the same 5 years, just under 900,000 Mexicans came to the U.S. So all told, a net flow back to Mexico of about 140,000 people. The Pew data suggests many returnees went back to Mexico to reunite with their family or to start one. But other researchers point to perhaps a bigger factor behind the trend, the economy, that is the lack of jobs here in the U.S. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 1 week ago, as the events in Paris were unfolding, we spoke with Marie Duzma. She's a contributor with our partners at Global Post and was in the streets of Paris watching things unfold that night. So we thought we'd check back in with her today just to see what Paris feels like now.
Paris is still very tangibly grieving, but, you know, people are trying very hard to go on with their lives, to be out, to be with people. It's a tentative feeling of trying to go on, trying to remember, still, you know, everybody glued to the news as things continue to unfold.
And since the siege in Saint-Denis earlier this week, are Parisians feeling a little better about things, or has that just left them even more unsettled?
I think that depends very much on who you talk to. I think people respond so differently to something like this. Some people have described, you know, a certain sense of, well, we just have to go on. I don't want to be scared. And even if, you know, even if you are scared, you're not going to act scared. Other people have talked about not wanting to leave their apartments. And even for people who are trying very hard to go out to visit the places that have turned into memorials. You probably heard about the panic that happened in Paris last Sunday night when many hundreds of people started running through the streets near the canal. That panic happened because people thought they heard gunshots. And so people are clearly very, very on edge.
There is a lot of talk in the U.S. about tightening up the screening process for refugees. Is that also a debate in France, even as François Hollande says he's going to keep admitting refugees and migrants?
It's very much a debate in France. It's been an increasing debate since the refugee crisis became so, so very present in Europe this summer. All of those questions are only magnified by last Friday's events.
And just personally, last Friday when you spoke with my colleague Jeb Sharp, you were in lockdown. Just remind us what you were feeling and sensing in that moment.
Yeah, so the restaurant was very close to the Bataclan where everything was unfolding that night with the hostage situation and the many deaths. It was a normal Friday evening for everybody until the gunshots started. And then we could see people from inside the restaurant running down the streets looking for somewhere safe to go. So that's when the restaurant went into lockdown mode, pulled down the metal shutters, but kept opening it partially to let in people from the streets who are looking for somewhere safe to go.
Have you been back to the restaurant where you were in lockdown since last Friday?
I did go back. I went back this afternoon to bring the staff flowers and to thank them for taking such good care of us. And the mood in the neighborhood is very subdued. Everybody knows somebody who was touched by this or who died from this or who is in the hospital. And the marquee from the concert last Friday night is still up announcing the Eagles of Death Metal. And some parts feel stuck in time and other parts feel like the city is trying to move on.
Reporter Marie Duzma in Paris with a powerful image of the marquee on the Bataclan Music Hall still up since last Friday. Before we close out the week here, let's pick up again with journalist Andy Morgan, who we spoke with earlier about the violence today in Mali. Some years ago, Morgan spent a long time managing bands from Mali, most notably the Tuareg group Tenariwen. And last Friday, as news emerged about the shootings at the Bataclan, he couldn't help but remember when Tenariwen played in the same venue. Morgan says the Bataclan is a big deal. Once you get to play there, you've made it.
In the rock and roll landscape, there's a certain small group of venues that if you play them, you kind of arrive. And what I mean by that is that you're out of the, as we say in England, rather irreverently, the toilet circuits. You know, you're on a bigger stage, people are taking notice. The Bataclan in France is definitely one of those places.
For Tenariwen, and I imagine for you managing them, going to the Bataclan must have been really exciting. Take us back to that night when Tenariwen played there.
Oh, it was just a sense of intensity. You know, suddenly we were in a much bigger venue. Robert Plant had been invited to come and join the band on stage. The tour bus that we were using at the time was parked outside the Bataclan. And during the afternoon, Ibrahim, the lead singer of Tenariwen, the founder, he had to sort of move between the venue and the tour bus. He was literally surrounded by fans.
Wow.
And we've never had fan issues before.
Groupie issues, just fans,
let alone the groupies. And what was amazing, these fans were all North African. What I started to realize is that Tenariwen were having a major impact in North Africa. They're seen as a kind of spearheading a kind of Berber revival in music.
Interesting.
And the Tuareg are a part of the Berber family. And that, to me, was new and very exciting.
Well, as you know, ISIS called the Bataclan a profligate prostitution party. And you said in your essay this week that, quote, anyone who walks out onto any stage in Paris or London or Madrid, Melbourne, Mumbai and Osaka is now in the front line of that battle. I get that. But what do you think really is a threat that art poses to ISIS right now? Don't you think they just chose a theater, any theater, because it's a soft target and lots of people would be inside?
ISIS, Daesh, they espouse a Wahhabist philosophy which says that all music is sinful. When the jihadists occupied the north of Mali in 2012, they banned any form of music. Ideologically, the people who run ISIS, they absolutely hate the Western culture of music, of rock and roll, of freedom. That kind of freedom is something that's complete anathema to them. So I think it was very, very specifically targeted for that reason.
I mean, I guess all of this is just such a strong reminder of how musical and rich with talent Mali is.
Mali is known for its music. In fact, even the former president used to joke when he went on foreign trips, he said, well, you may not have heard me, but I come from a place called Mali, and you've no doubt heard of Salif Keita and Rokia Traore and Amadou and Mariam, you know, and that's the president. So Mali's soft power, if it has any soft power, is a musical power. And the fact that the jihadists with their Wahhabi philosophy tried to ban it was a major trauma for the country.
If music is a sort of salvation, give us something, Andy, that you've been listening to this week that has helped to kind of put your own mental house in order.
When Tuareg music gets very acoustic, it's a very beautiful, soothing, and yet still raw type of music. And I've been listening to a singer called Faris Amin Botazzi, and he's half Tuareg, half Italian. And he's done this incredible album, which is a cover of blues standards. He's obviously making that very, very evident and very interesting connection between the blues of the Niger and the blues of America's Deep South. And it's very, very nice to chill out to.
Thanks very much for the recommendation, and we'll play some Faris Amin Butazi going out. Andy Morgan, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome, Marco.
It's been a tough week of news to report. I want to give a shout out to all of you for sticking with us. It's not been easy always to listen to, but we do need to know. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg, and I'm Marco Werman with The World from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Thanks very much. Until Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.